Today on KPR Presents, Sally Busby, University of Kansas alum and the new editor of The Washington Post. I'm Kay McIntyre. Busby was named executive editor of the Post on May 11th. She's the first woman to hold that position. She comes to The Washington Post after a long and successful career at the Associated Press, where she started as an AP reporter in Kansas, rising through the ranks to become the executive editor. Busby is from Olathe and graduated from the University of Kansas in 1988. She won the prestigious William Allen White Citation in 2019, joining a list of prominent journalists from NPR's Cokie Roberts to Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist Leonard Pitts. While Sally Busby was in Lawrence to receive the William Allen White Citation, she stopped by the KPR studios. Our conversation originally aired on April 28, 2019. Sally, thank you for stopping by the KPR studios while you're in town.
Thanks so much. I'm so happy to be here.
When you read the newspaper, you've probably noticed, or maybe not, that many of the stories come from AP, the Associated Press. But unless you work in the news business, that might not mean much to you. Sally, explain how the Associated Press works.
Yeah, so we're sort of a unique organization in some ways. We're actually a member cooperative, a nonprofit cooperative. We're not a charity, we're not an NGO, but we are essentially any proceeds that we make from the journalism that we do go back into the AP. We don't have shareholders or, you know, we're not owned as a private company or anything like that. Our members are American news organizations, and our customers span the globe. So what we do is we're essentially a news agency. We cover journalism in text and photos and video and graphics and all kinds of things like that. And then we sell our journalism to news organizations that put it in their news organizations, whether that is a newspaper in the middle of Kansas, or whether that is a state news agency in Denmark that puts it out like on a streaming app on smartphones in Copenhagen or something like that. So we also, we have a couple things that go sort of direct to the audience. We have a mobile app, you know, that's an AP branded mobile app. But the vast majority of what we do is we provide journalism, global journalism, to other news organizations.
And it should be said that Kansas Public Radio gets much of its news from this.
Good.
Associated
We're very
Press.
Glad. We hope you're satisfied customers.
The AP dates back to 1846. What was the driving force behind creating the AP, and how has it adapted to changing times? Because the world of news is a whole lot different in 2019 than it was in 1846.
Absolutely. So AP was created because U.S. newspapers essentially wanted to pool their resources to take both news that was coming in on, you know, steamer ships from Europe. In other words, there would be a something was happening in Europe and the news would be put on the ship and go across the ocean, and it would be in the harbor in New York. And then rather than sort of every New York City newspaper hiring their own rowboat, they hired one rowboat and sort of got the news and sort of shared it in a cooperative. And there was also news from the West Coast, the Pony Express and things like that. There was a desire to essentially pool resources in some situations and provide news that everybody could use. What's important about that is that that's sort of the bedrock of AP, because we have to present, we have to provide the sort of factual, objective journalism that any news organization can actually use and trust. And so those sort of historical beginnings are still incredibly important to us. It's very important that any news organization in the United States, whether they are left-leaning or right-leaning, would actually trust the journalism that we provide them so that they can put it in their news organization and be confident that it is accurate and fair and doesn't have a partisan bias to it. Our customers are also global, and so it's very important that, I mean, in a place as far away as the Mideast, we have news organizations in Qatar and news organizations in Saudi Arabia that both subscribe to the Associated Press. And those two countries are in conflict with each other. And so they both need to be able to trust that we're actually accurately reporting the story in the Middle East so that they can actually use that content also. So over the years, we have adapted enormously. I mean, we started out You know, using literally horses on the Pony Express to bring news from the Telegraph was a big innovation. Video, in the 70s, we bought a European television network called WTN and got much more heavily into video and into broadcast journalism. And obviously the internet and social media and the ways that people consume news now are radically changing about every 6 months. And so our goal is to be incredibly old-fashioned in our standards. We want accuracy and facts and objectivity to be our bedrock of what we do, but totally modern in how we present our journalism. And so, for example, you know, live video is something that's extremely interesting to a lot of people. Last week, I was in Europe and I was talking to people who are using our live video and putting it into smartphone apps that stream live video to their customers in a country like Norway. And so we're just trying to, you know, we don't care how people want to consume news. We don't care. What we care is that they care about consuming accurate and fact-based news.
Speaking of which, it is a tough time to be a journalist. The market is changing. The way we consume news is changing. What do you see as some of the biggest challenges facing those of us in the media today?
I think there's several things, and I think a lot of these, they're not unique to me. I think it's what a lot of people are seeing. We do live, especially in the U.S., but all across the world, in a very highly partisan sort of atmosphere. And that's obviously a challenge. People see the world in radically different ways, and sometimes they don't have as much sympathy with the other person's point of view. And so adhering to not a plain vanilla sort of non-interesting middle, but trying to be fair and trying to accurately express what is factually happening, but also being conscious of sort of the political currents that are out there so that you're expressing different points of view in a fair but accurate way. I think that's very challenging. I think that technology is allowing the spread of misinformation to be very dangerous for our world. I don't think that the spread of misinformation is a new thing. That has been happening since the caveman era, okay? But I do think that technology is enabling the spread of it to be so fast. And so let's say you're in a country like Myanmar and, you know, there have been sectarian and ethnic tensions in a country like that forever. But there used to be, if I wanted to spread a nasty rumor about a different ethnic group, I could maybe tell 10 people. I could tell my neighbors and they could spread it. If I can put it on social media and I can basically have it spread like wildfire across the whole country in the spread of 10 seconds, that's a dangerous and very new thing that's happening in our world. So I think technology is sort of, unfortunately, sort of accelerating some of the dangers that are happening out there with misinformation. So for news organizations, it's making sure that we're sticking to our values, but also that we're being transparent enough about how we gather the news, that people trust us and that they don't mistrust us or think that we're elites who are talking down to them. I think that's an enormous challenge. I feel like I try to make the AP more and more transparent about how we gather news and what our standards are every day. And I feel like I'm always struggling to be as transparent as I should be and as the public wants us to be. So to me, that's one of the big challenges of the future.
One of the previous winners of the William Allen White National Citation, Leonard Pitts, said, I think this was maybe 10 or 15 years ago, that in this era of social media, if everyone can be a journalist, then no one is a journalist. That where's the fact checking? Where's the reliability? And part of that comes from the fact that there is an element of fake news out there. It's easy to spread misinformation. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But there's also an element of our leadership claiming things are fake news when they're really not. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. How do we in the media regain that sense of trust and reliability and say, yes, the news that we're providing is trustworthy? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. How do we do that?
I mean, I think those are the questions that we're all grappling with. I don't feel as overwhelmed or hopeless as perhaps some people do, because I think first of all, there's a couple things to keep in mind. When we say that people no longer believe in facts, I think that's a gross overstatement. People clearly believe in facts. They look at the weather forecast on their local television thing, and they, if someone says there's a tornado barreling down on you, they go to their basement. So they clearly believe in some facts.
Unless you live in Kansas, in which case you go out to the back porch and
exactly.
watch for it.
Exactly. You might watch for it or go chase it. Exactly. If a advertising thing says there's a sale on cars this Saturday, they probably generally believe that there's going to be a sale on cars. Around political news, which is the most difficult thing in the United States right now, there is grave mistrust. And some of that, I think, is because people do, they are hardened, they are able to get information that feeds their worldview. And so there's not as much sort of random information that doesn't feed their worldview that's available to them. I think there's also a strong feeling in this country that some news organizations talk down to people and that they tell people what they should think versus what they might actually think. And so, you know, all of those currents, whether they're good or bad or whether they're real or true, are causing some of the things that are happening in the U.S. where people do mistrust, I would say, a lot of political news because they think it might be politically driven or it's said by an agenda. I don't think that there's any one solution. I think that journalist organizations sticking to their standards and saying that we're not going to let the mistrust in this country make us lose our path is incredibly important. But I do think that being more transparent about how we gather news and what standards we have and keeping ourselves from becoming partisan is enormously important. I think that there's definitely, I mean, some of the things that do scare me, I think that if political leaders in the United States talk about, accuse journalist organizations of promulgating fake news, you see a clear ripple effect with authoritarian leaders overseas where they start to echo those conversations. So when that happens in the United States, we see pressure on our journalists in Poland. We see pressure on our journalists in the Philippines. We see pressure on journalists in Myanmar, where authoritarian leaders essentially mimic what American political leaders say. So that is deeply concerning. There's just no question about that. We have a reporter in Poland who covered in a very factual and sober way a far right rally in Poland. And she was called out on national television by name as being somebody who was pushing around fake news. That's deeply worrying. I mean, it imperils her security. It imperils the trust of are we being accurate? Those things are deeply concerning. I don't want to in any way downplay that. But I also think that I try to keep a long view. Like, let's stick to journalism. Let's stick to fact-based reporting. Let's not become partisan. Let's not become, fall into some of these traps in the U.S. And I fundamentally believe that in the long term, people will trust news organizations that stand for something and that have a record of accuracy. One of the things that most made me happy was one time someone who was just a normal person in the United States, not a sophisticated consumer of news or anything, just a normal person. And they said to me that they remembered when all the rumors started flying that Michael Jackson had died, when he died of the drug overdose. And they said that they didn't really trust that Michael Jackson was actually dead until the AP reported that Michael Jackson was actually dead. And I was like, wow, that's really, now, I mean, there's a lot of other news about Michael Jackson that's very unhappy. I'm not talking about that, but that I want people to trust that we will tell them what has actually factually happened on this planet. If we can keep that, I think there's a lot of long-term strength to what we think of news. I do think that news organizations need to be very, I mean, look, we're not doing everything right, okay? We're not transparent enough. Maybe sometimes, there's plenty of news organizations in the United States that have an East Coast bias. That's a real thing. OK, there were a lot of news organizations that didn't think that Donald Trump was going to win the presidency, and he won the presidency fair and square under our rules. OK, so mistakes happen and we're not perfect. We need to be as non-defensive as humanly possible, stick to our standards and try to do the best job we can. And I have quite a bit of optimism if we do that.
I'm visiting with Sally Busby of the Associated Press. She's the winner of this year's William Allen White National Citation, awarded April 11th, 2019 at the Kansas Union. Sally, you spent 5 years at the AP's Middle East Bureau stationed in Cairo. Talk to me about the special challenges that journalists face reporting in that part of the world, especially female journalists.
Yeah, great question. Female journalists face a lot of challenges in that side of the world. So when I went to Cairo, it was really because I thought that I really wanted to push myself and to learn as much about journalism as I could and try to take on a totally new challenge. I had been in Washington. I knew a lot about political coverage, and I just wanted something totally new. And it didn't disappoint me because it's a very, very difficult part of the world to report from. But I also think that there's an enormous amount of good reporting from that corner of the world. And in particular, women journalists in the Mideast are in this incredible sort of period where they're sort of blossoming and coming forward and doing enormously brave things. One of our reporters, Sarah Eldeeb, who is Egyptian and has worked for AP her entire life in the Mideast, she's based in Lebanon now, has been doing fabulous coverage of the Islamic State and of Syria and the aftermath of the Islamic State in Syria, where there's all these women and children who are like, what happens now? And just brave and very, like, the best coverage you could possibly hope for. Another of our Egyptian reporters, Maggie Michael, has been covering the Yemen war in an enormously brave and courageous way. One of our women photographers based in Cairo, Nariman El-Mufti, who's also Egyptian, has been doing incredibly insightful photojournalism coverage of Yemen. And she's able to actually, you know, get behind the scenes with women and sort of tell the stories of, she took a beautiful and shocking photo of a emaciated Yemeni woman who actually was willing to pull up her face scarf and show how emaciated her neck was from essentially starvation, a photo that got an enormous amount of attention. And a male photographer is not going to be able to get into that culture and get a woman to trust him in that way. And so Nariman is, I think, one of the most talented emerging photojournalists in the entire world. And you know, she's an Egyptian woman who's essentially discovering her career. So there's enormous challenges. They face danger, sexual harassment, all sorts of things, but they're well trained, they're educated, and they're just really brave and resourceful. And so there's a lot of hope among those things. When I went to Cairo, it was in the throes of the Iraq war, and the Iraq war really starting to turn bad, and the U.S. really getting bogged down in the Iraq war. And I learned an enormous amount. I learned how to cover a war. I learned how to keep people safe in conflict coverage, which is an enormously important thing to know. I learned about the bravery and the commitment of people overseas who cover these wars. A lot of the photographers and reporters who we had covering the Iraq war were people who had grown up during the Balkans wars and had done all that coverage and then, you know, shifted to what the next conflict was. I also have a lot of worry that journalists who are constantly in conflict zones, you know, it's a wear and tear. I mean, I want to keep them safe physically. That's what most of our attention is focused on. But the wear and tear on their mental health and their emotions over time is also very, very intense. And I think needs to be, you know, cared for and minded. For me, it was just incredibly, I pushed myself. It was like my big growth experience was going to the Middle East and grappling with that very difficult war. We talk about misinformation. I mean, the U.S. military was very defensive when the Iraq war started to go bad and, you know, accused U.S. news organizations of overstating how bad Baghdad had become and things like that. And so I think it's important for us to remember that, you know, being accused of misinformation is not a new thing. This is something that pops up all the time when things are in trouble. News organizations tend to get accused of, you're being unpatriotic, you're overemphasizing how bad the war in Iraq is. Turned out we weren't being unpatriotic and we weren't telling a misstatement. I mean, we weren't telling a factual error. It was bad. And eventually the U.S. military acknowledged that and took steps to try to, you know, get out of Iraq, essentially. So I think improve the going of the war and pull out eventually. So I think to me, that's a good lesson that news organizations that tell the truth and that factually report are going to get attacked sometimes. That's part of the ground that we're on. People aren't going to like what we say, but the world really needs to know how the, I mean, Americans needed to know how the Iraq war was actually factually going. And so some of these lumps we just kind of have to take. And being in the Mideast gave me such an amazing perspective. When I went back to Washington and was Washington bureau chief, having those 5 years in the Middle East was the entire difference to me in terms of like being able to be an effective Washington bureau chief and understanding both how important the United States is in the world, but also not just keeping my, not just saying horse race, political coverage is everything. Like what America does matters to the world. It has an enormous impact. And it gave me that perspective in really important ways.
I'm visiting with Sally Busby of the Associated Press, this year's winner of the William Allen White National Citation. Sally, the news business, like a lot of industries, is coming to rely more and more on automation. Mm-hmm. How is that playing out in the Associated Press?
So what we try to do with automation is think of it as how can it make us more efficient so that we can put journalists onto the deep reporting that they alone can do. So I think of this in two ways. I think that if you're using automation to sort of like, you know, search a database of information, whether it's a campaign finance database or something like that, and get you surface information for you, I think that's a very valuable thing. In other words, if we can use technology as one of the tools of reporting that we use to tell good stories, I think that's very important. We also use it sometimes just to do some, you know, very sort of low-level rote tasks so that we can get our journalists focused on the places where they can have the most impact, where their brains can figure out what those stories are and do the reporting that they alone can do. And so, for example, you know, one of the things we play around when we do a video shoot, we write a script off of it, a transcript of the, if I can use a transcription software to kind of do a first take of that, and then a human brain looks at, you know, a person looks at it and corrects the errors and things like that, there's just an efficiency that I can build into our news workflow so that we can use our precious and experienced journalists to essentially do the deeper tasks, the deeper thinking, the deeper reporting that they alone can do. So we just sort of, I think we think of it as one of the tools we have to report as efficiently as we possibly can and to make sure that every reporting resource, I mean, all news organizations have budget challenges now. There's, I don't know of a single one that doesn't. Maybe they exist, but never seen them. Okay. And so I want to make sure that every precious dollar that we have in our news budget is going to break as much news across the world as we can possibly do it. That's, you know, that's our goal, essentially, that we have as big of a staff as we can and that we have as much ability to go out and report as we possibly can. So if we can use automation to make a couple things more efficient so that we can leverage our staff into the things that have more value, I fundamentally believe that, you know, journalism is never, you're going to suffer if you don't think that the human brain is the core of journalism. Thinking about what's interesting in our world and how we tell people those stories is fundamental and foundational to what makes journalism important to people.
Sally, I want to follow up on something you just alluded to, and that's that news organizations like the Associated Press, like Kansas Public Radio, all are facing financial issues. There are fewer newspapers than there used to be, so that means fewer subscribers to AP. There are fewer radio stations with news departments, and that means fewer subscribers to AP. How do you meet those financial challenges and continue to be a strong news organization when there are real financial pressures on you?
Absolutely. I mean, maybe I'm just kind of a weird person, but I would rather work in news right now when there were these challenges than a lot of people are sort of like, oh, in the good old days we had, I don't know, you know, platters of food brought in every day or something. I mean, I don't know, whatever ridiculous things they say. We had Western reporters in every capital internationally, okay? I would personally rather work in news during a time of financial constraint when I think the decisions that we make are actually more important, because my goal in this job and the goal of the president of the AP and the goal of all the wonderful people who work at AP is to keep this institution alive and kicking into the future. And I think we all feel a real mission that regardless of whatever financial challenges that we or anybody face, our job is to keep the news report strong. And the world is not going to be in a good position if independent news organizations disappear. No one's going to like that future, okay? And I think that my goal is to embrace these challenges and to do the best and most creative job we can at keeping our international and our domestic news report as strong as possible. And I think that's a very energizing challenge. It can be, I mean, look, there's some terrible tragedies happening in the U.S. We wrote a story a couple weeks ago about a small town paper in Missouri that had had to fold. And it was just enormously heart-wrenching. I mean, even the local police chief was saying, I miss the local paper. You think of a police chief and the local paper as being in conflict. And he was like, oh, God, I can't believe the paper's gone away. So there's some terrible churn and problems in the U.S. news industry. But my feeling is, again, that we try to hold on to our standards and hold on to what we know we do well, which is to accurately cover what's happening in the world. But then just be as creative and resourceful as we possibly can about stretching every dollar that we have, and also telling news in the way that people consume it. I mean, it's not for me to say, I mean, look, I love newspapers. I love holding a printed newspaper in my hand and reading it. That's a real nirvana to me. But if people want to read their news on their phones, it's not for me to say that that's a bad thing for them to do. That's a consumer habit that changed. And so I want to be where they consume news. I want our news to be. So one of our, you know, some of our challenges are just staying modern focused and making sure that whoever controls the platforms that people consume news on going forward, I want them to think of AP as a credible news source that they will go to for their journalism. And so our strategy is to help our existing customers survive these challenging times, but also reach out to the new players in the field and make sure that they understand. I think it's important that the big technology companies understand that there is a difference between credible, fact-based journalism from reputable, you know, purveyors of that journalism and misinformation that just travels around. And a part of our effort is to have those conversations with them and try to make sure that that's understood. Also, I think there's some, you know, maybe in the past we thought we need a Western reporter in the Mideast. I think that that was, actually perhaps some bias in the past. And I actually think that our Middle Eastern journalists are incredibly smart and very sophisticated and very independent thinking. And they come from a wide variety of backgrounds. Some of them are Christian, some of them are Muslim, some of them are women, some of them are men, some of them are Western educated, some of them are locally educated. And I actually think, I mean, we still put Western reporters around the world, not as many as we used to. I think they're a pretty damn good group of journalists who we can depend on going forward to do the kind of news coverage that we want to do.
There's been a lot of discussion over the past few months about how we in the media choose our words, whether to use words and phrases like racially charged mm-hmm. or racist, or how we challenge a statement that is factually incorrect. Do we say this is a lie? At the Associated Press, who's the final judge? Who's the final arbiter of whether we consider a word pejorative?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a great question. So we try to talk about things like that. And we try to make sure that, I mean, look, I have my own opinions. I have my own sort of, but I don't really think that I should be making decisions in a vacuum because I come from my background and I'm me. And I don't know that my worldview encompasses everything that we should be thinking of. So specifically on the issue of racially tinged versus racist, which is a very vital issue right now, very front and center, we had a series of conversations in our newsroom probably, I think it's only about 3 months ago, because this issue kept coming up where we would say racially tinged or something like that. And our own journalists in our newsroom, sometimes it was people of color, sometimes it was, not people of color, were saying, I'm uncomfortable with that wording. It doesn't really capture exactly what's happening here. Why are we afraid of saying that something is racist if it's overtly racist? And so we actually started a series of conversations. I'm involved in those conversations, but so are some of our normal working journalists, reporters, editors. We have a standards editor who's also involved in that conversation. But we sort of, you know, we did some outreach across the company and also some outreach to some outside groups, a pretty wide diversity of outside groups. And we came up with some new guidance that essentially said if something is very clearly and overtly racist, and we sort of defined racist, which I'm not going to be able to probably say off the top of my head, but if someone is very clearly making a delineation based on whether something is good or bad versus, you know, something is good or bad based purely on the race of the person, I mean, that's racist, right? And so, you know, we set up some circumstances and said, if it's a pig, call it a pig. But be careful and thoughtful and go through a thought process to do that. Okay. And don't fall back on words like, I mean, we didn't outlaw anything. We just gave some sort of new guidance about think more deeply about some of these things. And here's some guidelines to help you think about those things. So our style book and our standards are not a set document. They're a living thing that changes minute by minute. And it changes based on the feedback that we get from the public. I mean, we pay attention to what the public says to us, right? And, you know, some of it is obviously very, I mean, I don't pay attention if somebody writes me a threatening note that is clearly horrible and disrespectful. But if anybody thoughtful is like, I think you're biased this way, I'm going to pay attention to that. Like, what is it that we're doing that's making you think that? And so I think that's a really important thing. You know, on lie, which is something that we've really had a lot of debate on. I mean, I think you have to understand someone's intent to say they're lying. But if they clearly have been told repeatedly that something is factually inaccurate and continue to say it, and we know that they know is factually inaccurate, I think the word lie is perfectly appropriate in that circumstance. And I think, you know, we try to use words like that very selectively and carefully. And we try to have conversation about it ahead of time. But I don't, our standards are, they're rooted in our effort to be fair and factual, but they are in a state of constant flux, especially the use of the language, right? Because language, I mean, you know, George Orwell said it best for us. I mean, language determines what you think. It's not a separate, just stylistic matter. It has real impact on how people think about things. And so we try to be very mindful of using words that are as accurate and don't have hidden meanings as much as humanly possible. But, you know, are we ever going to get to perfection? Absolutely not. Our newsroom is not a dictatorial or top-down newsroom. I mean, I think the way newsrooms work the best is to have a lot of smart people who do a lot of thinking. I am absolutely the final signer-offer in the AP, and I'm on the news judgment, and I'm responsible for what our style book says, and I'm responsible for our decision that there are certain things that we can say are racist. But I depend on all the smart journalists in the AP to think these things through and recommend what they think the best course is.
I'm visiting with Sally Busby of the Associated Press. The name Busby may be a familiar one to those who follow Kansas news. Your father-in-law, Dick Busby, had a long and distinguished career as the editor and publisher of the Hutchinson News and Olathe Daily before he passed away last year. What kind of lessons did he share from the front lines?
Yeah, we miss him so much. And my daughters miss him so much. And we just really, boy, it's hard to come back to Kansas and have, you know, Grandpa Dick not be here. But he was such a wonderful journalist. I think that what Dick had that I found so heartening and so energizing. I mean, he really was in many ways sort of the ideal of a small town editor and publisher. And Hutchinson's not a small town, but by that I mean someone really invested in their community. There's a couple stories that I just really adore about him. One was during the Vietnam War, and this is very apocryphal. I wasn't there at the time. I've heard this through family legend, but The Vietnam War was going on, and it was, of course, a very, very fraught time. People were very intensely divided about the Vietnam War. And he started this drive at the Olathe Daily News, which, where he was the editor and publisher at the time, to raise money to bring young men from Olathe who were over serving in Vietnam in the war home for Christmas. Apparently, there was some program where they could, you know, get a 2-week leave to go see their families for Christmas, but there had to be money raised to let them do it. And he, the newspaper, got behind a drive to raise money in the community and was able to bring some soldiers home, right? And so in the midst of this partisan bitterness over whether the Vietnam War was a good thing or a bad thing, that he sort of cut through that and was able to just say, these are local boys who are over there and they should see their families on Christmas. And I just love that story because that to me is just like the absolute epitome of what a community editor and publisher should care about, like bringing their community around something that everybody actually believes in. I think at the Hutchinson News, which is such a fascinating paper because it always had a readership both in the city but also across Western Kansas and all that kind of thing. And I think just being in touch with that community and understanding what their concerns were and you know, it's a fairly conservative community, and just sort of making sure that they trusted the local newspaper and that they trusted the news that they found in there. It's still a pretty vital newspaper. I have to say, I visited a little bit last summer with some of the editors there, and it's doing a really good job of kind of staying invested in the community. Its circulation has fallen, just like pretty much everyone, but I think it still has its finger on the pulse of like what's going on there. And I think that that is just, to me, sort of the legacy of you kind of want to be in the community and you want people to trust you and know who you are and feel like they have a connection with that local paper or publication. And that's really critical in many ways. So it just, like I said, it's really kind of heartbreaking for us to be here and have him not be here. But I have a soft spot in my heart for the Hutchinson News and will until the day I die.
That's Sally Busby, KU alum and new executive editor of the Washington Post. Busby stopped by the KPR studios in April 2019 when she won the William Allen White National Citation. We'll have her remarks from William Allen White Day coming up as KPR Presents continues right after this.